You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
I'm Natalie Spencer. I'm a senior researcher here at the RSA, and it's a pleasure to welcome you all to today's event, The Psychology of Money, with Claudia Hammond. Claudia is a writer, broadcaster, and psychology lecturer. She is BBC Radio 4's Voice of Psychology and presents the programs All in the Mind and Mind Changers. Claudia has been awarded the British Psychological Society's Public Engagement and Media Award, Mind's Making a Difference Award, the Society of Personality and Social Psychology's Media Achievement Award, and the British Neuroscience Association's Public Understanding of Neuroscience Award. She's the author of several books, including her recent Mind Over Money. And I'm particularly interested in this event because here at the RSA, we've also been exploring the psychology of financial capability. About a year ago now, we published a report called called Wired for Imprudence, The Behavioral Hurdles to Financial Capability. And that's available on the RSA website if you'd like to visit it. So I'm very much looking forward to hearing Claudia's insights today on the sometimes surprising quirks of our mind when it comes to money. Please join me in welcoming Claudia Hammond.
Hi, everybody, and thanks so much for having me here today. And I do recommend the report that Natalie's just mentioned. It's really very, very interesting. It's lovely to be back at the RSA. I've talked here before, and it's always nice, and there's always lots of interesting questions that people have, so I shall look forward to those. Now, this is a £50 note, but just here I have a £5 note. And so those of you at the front might be able to see this is a real £5 note. And I'm going to do something I've never done before, which is that this is a tiny little shredder. I'm not going to burn the money because I don't want to set all your alarms off here, but I am going to shred this £5 note. Now, it certainly makes me uncomfortable. Now, this may make you feel uncomfortable. Oh, it comes out very neatly. If it does, you're not alone. And I should reassure you that I will be donating £5 to my favourite charity, which is the suicide prevention charity Maitri, to make up for this with these little bits here. But it does make people feel very uncomfortable to see money destroyed, even though these are just bits of paper, shreds of paper now. You know, we know that they are just paper, and yet they seem to mean something so much more to us. And famously, there was a group of people who burnt £1 million, much more bravely than my £5 there. And so the Kay Foundation, who were the band KLF, who you may remember from hits like 3 AM Eternal and things like that in the 90s, they famously upset a lot of people when they went to the Isle of Jura, and as what they said was a work of art, they burnt £1 million. They found this little hut, a shepherd's hut, and they burnt their £1 million in it, which takes, you can still watch the video of it on YouTube, it takes ages for them to burn, and they get quite bored with throwing them in on the end. And that was back in 1994, and people really hated them for it. People were furious that they'd done such a thing, and constantly asked them why. They said it was art, but they also sounded slightly confused when people asked them why, and sort of troubled by so many people asking them why it had happened. They said it's just paper, what does it matter? They said there's no less bread in the world, there are no fewer apples in the world, why should we care so much? And what I'm interested in is not so much why they wanted to do it, as why everyone hated them so much for it. If they'd just wasted their money in straightforward, you know, rock star fashion and thrown televisions out of hotel windows or spent a fortune on drugs or fancy cars or holidays or yachts, people wouldn't have minded. And yet people minded that it was spent on nothing, that it was wasted. And psychological experiments since have confirmed how much we hate seeing money destroyed. This is a piece of research that was done by the psychologists and neuroscientists, a couple, Uta and Chris Thrift. And they ran a study with colleagues in Denmark. And they showed people films, this film of a banknote being destroyed, and some of the people, they were in a brain scanner while they watched this film. Some of the people watched a piece of paper of the same size that what clearly wasn't a note being destroyed. And they found exactly the same thing. People found it distressing watching this money be destroyed. Interestingly, a part of the brain that was activated when they saw the real money destroyed is one associated with the use of tools, with using, pen knives or knives or cutlery or things like that. There is an extent to which, you know, money is a tool, and this is why people were so upset about the £1 million, that, you know, obviously money represents opportunity and choice. It represents a choice of all sorts of things that you can do with it, that when you exchange it. And that's because we've all decided to agree that it does. And interestingly, when it comes to the brain, even though money represents something you can get in the future, like someone gives you some money now, you need to go and exchange it for something to have an actual thing. But again, research using brain scanners has shown that we know that the reward centres will be activated when people have something like squirts of apple juice put into their mouth, or chocolate, or something nice. And different parts of the brain are activated for the promise of a chocolate in the future, or the promise of apple juice in the future. That's different. The promise of something nice, a bottle of wine or something, that will be different in the future. But what's really interesting is, if you give people some money while they're in the scanner, that same part of the brain for immediate rewards is activated. Even though you can't have the object you can exchange it for straight away, there's something we really love about receiving some money. And it is, you know, feels very rewarding to us because, you know, it does represent so much. And it is fascinating that money is a future reward, really, and yet it means so much to us. Now, what I'm interested in is our psychological relationship with money. My book is not about economics or business or markets. What I've set out to do is to look at the best research from around the world that's looking at the topic of money and our minds, to see what it can tell us about some of the curiosities there are about an individual's relationship with money, and also what we can do about it, not necessarily with the aim of making us richer, but to have a healthier relationship with it and to use it better to enable our well-being or increase the well-being of other people as well. I don't have one single thesis except that it's clear that money changes our thinking, our feeling, and our behaviour, and that when it's scarce, it can have even more of a hold over us. But I do think by looking at the evidence that there is around money, we can look at some of the mental traps, the cognitive traps, if you like, that we can fall into, and then we can have what I call mind over money. Now, we constantly make assumptions about money that say big bonuses will encourage chief executives to try harder, or that we can bribe our children to do their homework, or that when we're faced with a set of deals, we know exactly which one to choose, that we know which one is best. But as I'll show, the evidence shows we're not always right about this at all. We all decide that this piece of paper has value, or actually probably doesn't have value anymore. We've all decided to agree that this is the case. Now, I don't think that money is the root of all evil. Obviously, it can cause trouble, but it is a useful system. It allows us to trust each other, to make deals with strangers, and to do all sorts of wonderful things. The difficulty is that our relationship with it isn't always straightforward. Now, we do tend to think that we're very good at spotting a bargain, just as most of us think we're above average drivers, which is obviously impossible for us all to be above average drivers. Why then do we do things like we'll bid more in an auction just because the previous item that has nothing to do with ours and is nothing like ours has gone for more money? We will spend hours online or drive for miles to save £10 or £20 on something cheap, and then we fail to shop around to save £20 on something big like a car. We just think it doesn't matter anymore, and yet it's the same £20. It should matter just as much. We get much more pleasure from winning, say, £25 in a lottery one day and £50 in a lottery another day than we do from winning £75 all in one go. Again, it's the same amount. It should mean the same thing to us. And we're not even very good at judging what is good value. In fact, if something looks expensive, or if we're told something is expensive, then we're very easily fooled by that. I want to tell you the story of a man called Rudy Kernyawan. He was a dealer in vintage wine. In 2006, in just 1 year, he was dealing in $36 million of wine. And he was very, very generous. He would insist on taking all the other people in the wine business out for luxurious dinners and buying very, very expensive bottles of wine from the restaurants and treating everyone. And people were very impressed with how much he seemed to know about wine. And he was very young and seemed to have come from nowhere, and people were very impressed with this. Everyone loved his wine. And these were real experts who liked his wine and would spend an absolute fortune on his wine. But he did have one rather strange habit, which was that after he drank these expensive wines in restaurants, he would always insist that the restaurant sent the empty bottles to his home and that they would have them sent round. And he said that he was starting a museum of wine in his house, and this was why he needed the empty bottles. And everyone thought, oh, well, fair enough. Eventually, he was uncovered as a fraud, and he is now in prison for that. And what he did was, in his kitchen, he had, this is what they found when they searched his house. In his kitchen, he had all these caps ready to put back onto bottles of wine. He had, instead of a corkscrew to take corks out, he had a piece of equipment for putting corks back into bottles of wine. He would get the fancy bottles from the restaurants, soak the labels off that you can see there on the right, and then he would dip them in tea, that old good traditional method of making things look old, and stick them on new bottles, and he would mix some real vintage wine with cheap wine, and that was how he created more and more bottles. But he did make some mistakes, like having wine with from a year before an actual vineyard had started making wine and things like that. And that was how he eventually got caught. And it's thought to be the largest wine fraud in history. What's really interesting is that because people were told the wine was good and was expensive, they believed that it must be because it had this price on it. Loads of the wine had to be thrown away, and it was all poured down the drain and destroyed. There were some bottles that they thought could be saved, and so they the US Marshals, trying to make back what money they could for people who'd been defrauded, did have an auction of some of the wine just before Christmas this year. And they said that they thought it was probably real, but they couldn't absolutely guarantee it. And yet, three bottles of a 1911 Romanée Conti went for $43,000, even though people knew it was his, which you think might put you off, but it didn't, because they do think that some of them were real. Now, although this example might suggest to the contrary, what is interesting is that on the whole, wine experts do better than the rest of us at tastings, which you would hope they do. In an analysis of 6,000 blind tastings, only the experts knew which were genuinely expensive. So for the rest of us, if people were told it was expensive, then they thought it tasted better. So they, again, put people in a brain scanner. They fed them wine through a straw, which may not be the ideal way of drinking wine, but who knows. And they told them it cost anywhere between $5 and $90. And people liked the ones that they were told were expensive much more. But what's really interesting is that our brains are wine snobs too, if you like, because there was more activity in the reward centres for the ones where they were told it was expensive. So they were actually genuinely enjoying it more because they thought it was more expensive. So I think the lesson for the rest of us in this might be not to go on a wine course and become an expert, because then the cheap wine won't taste as good, and to get your friends to pretend they've brought round really expensive wine when they haven't, and then maybe you'll like it. Now, we love things that we know to be expensive so much that sometimes it is worth paying more for the same thing. If you take painkillers, this is ibuprofen, cheap. So it's the cheap generic version that you can buy for not very much. And this is a fancier version. They have the same ingredients, but one has lovely fancy packaging and is branded, and it shows it's powerful with the picture. And when they've in a trial, people's headaches actually went faster if they took the expensive branded one, even though they contain the same thing. So in a way, there was the placebo effect was harnessed, and the fact that they thought it was going to be good meant it was. So if your headache is really, really bad, maybe you do want to spend more on exactly the same thing, that maybe it does actually work. Or if you take an all-you-can-eat buffet. Obviously, the idea with an all-you-can-eat buffet is to get as much food as you can for as little money as possible. But there was a study done in the States where they some of the people paid a higher price and some of them paid a lower price. The people who paid the higher price actually enjoyed the meal much more, and they felt less full at the end, which suggests that when it was cheap, that people were more tempted to overeat because it was such a bargain. Whereas when it was expensive and they were paying more, they actually took more care over it, perhaps more care over choosing, and didn't overeat. But this doesn't mean that you should always just buy the most expensive item or even go for the mid-priced item. Now, I want you to imagine you want to buy a laptop and you don't want anything fancy. You just want to be able to, browse the web with it and write some documents on it and keep some stuff on it. So it really doesn't need to be anything fancy, but you want to be able to carry it about. So you decide, well, there's lots of cheap laptops around, I'm going to go and buy one. And you will often find that they're laid out in threes, particularly online, but also in shops as well. They're often laid out in threes, many products they do this with. And so this is from a real website. So you have here, if you can't see that from there, this is a cheap laptop for £329. This is a bit fancier, same make, but a bit fancier, more memory and so on, faster processing speeds, and that's £479. But then cleverly next to it, you'll find this very fancy one, which is £1,999. And it all looks sleek and beautiful and it's lovely. And this is actually very clever because what people will do psychologically is they came in, they were going to buy the cheap item. And then they had a quick look and they saw the really fancy one and they thought, no, I don't need anything as fancy as that. I can't afford that. That's too expensive. I won't have that. And they then think, I'm being very good about this, and they compromise. It's called the compromise effect. They compromise on buying the middle one instead, when they never intended to do that. If they'd just seen the two, they'd have thought, well, what's the point in getting the more expensive one? The cheaper one looks fine for what I need it for. And so people will very often be tempted to buy the mid-priced item. Since reading all the research on this, I've tried very hard not to buy the mid-priced item, but it's very, very tempting. I just find myself wanting to do it all the time, thinking, yeah, but that one, it's quite nice. And then I find myself trying to persuade myself, but no, look, it's got this. It must be better. So, but once we know about these things, we can try to have mind over money, if you like. We can try to observe these biases in ourselves. Now, interestingly, we can also get distracted by completely irrelevant prices through what's known as anchoring. There's been lots of work done on this by Daniel Kahneman and others that you might know of, which is where a number affects our decisions, even though it's completely irrelevant. It makes a difference to our decisions. So in one study, people were asked how much they would be prepared to pay for a menu in a restaurant, an imaginary restaurant called Studio 17, and how much they would be prepared to pay in a restaurant called Studio 97. And actually, people were prepared to pay more in the second restaurant, even though the word 97 in its title, had absolutely nothing to do with anything. But they would pay much more for the second meal. So if you are starting a restaurant yourself, I don't recommend calling it that, because that really won't do very, very well at all. Now, there are all sorts of cognitive biases that mean we don't always make the best financial decisions. And the optimism bias is an obvious one. Most of us think we will be better off in the future. We think we'll earn more in the future. We think we'll save more in the future. And we think we'll spend less in the future. Just as we all think we'll have more time in the future and that we'll be more organised versions of ourselves. And I don't want to disappoint you, but sadly you probably won't, unless you're going to take some real steps to do that. You're not going to have more time in the future or be more organised. Nor are you probably going to save more and spend less unless you take real steps to do this. Research shows that we make better decisions when we're feeling grumpy and also when we're not desperate for money. So actually going shopping when you're feeling grumpy or going to do something where you really want to think about whether it's a good deal while you're grumpy, maybe looking at houses, is a good idea. Some of you will know, we also make better decisions when we're not desperate for money, and some of you will know the research from Sendhil Malanathan in the States on scarcity, and where he found that when something such as money becomes more scarce, people's thinking narrows and their IQ can even drop, and they become more likely to make unwise decisions because of the stress of and the cognitive overload of trying to deal with not having enough money and being really worried about where you're going to get your rent at the end of the week or whatever it is you need. So no wonder then that people get stuck with debts that they can't pay. You know, no one sets out to get stuck with big debts. People genuinely believe they can pay it back. Now, struggling to make ends meet is undoubtedly hugely stressful. But what about the opposite? One big question with money that people always ask is, you know, does money make people happy or not? And stories of lottery winners seem to hold a strange fascination for us, because we know that there are these people who suddenly find themselves stratospherically wealthy, and we try to imagine what that would be like for that to suddenly happen like that. We also, interestingly, expect the winners to be deserving, even though the word lottery is in the title. And we don't like it if we find that, you know, people have a terrible criminal past and win loads of money. People then say, well, it should be paid to the victim for their crime. It is a lottery, so that, can happen. But we also quite like the stories where it all goes wrong, which make us all feel a bit better. And there seem to be lots of these, in particular, in the US. There was William Budd Post III, and he won $16 million in 1998. The judge ruled that he must give a third to his landlady. He then married seven times and got divorced six times. He went to prison for firing a shotgun at a debt collector. He went bankrupt. His brother hired a hitman to try to kill him. So it didn't really go well, and he ended up calling it the lottery of death and said that he would rather he'd never won. But things went even worse for Abraham Shakespeare, who won $31 million in 2006. First, a colleague accused him of having stolen the winning ticket from his wallet. And then he met a woman who wanted to write a book about him, and she wanted to write a book about how everyone was after his money and how everyone treated him badly now that he'd won this money and he couldn't trust anybody. And she kindly offered to take over his financial affairs for him. You can see where this is going. And then later, his body was found buried under concrete, and she is in prison for his murder, having got the money for herself as well. So it doesn't always go well. But in fact, a Swedish study of lottery winners shows that most people are very careful with their money. You know, with the ones we might read in the papers about people who have spent it all in a year and are now in massive debt, or where things have gone really wrong, like for these ones. But actually, most people who win the lottery are very careful about how they spend it. But there is a downside to winning the lottery, which could make the rest of us feel better, and that is known as the experience stretching hypothesis, which is that people with less money savour experiences more. So just showing people photos of money primed them to reduce the average time that they savoured chocolate for, down from 45 seconds on average to 32 seconds. So the idea is that if you can afford the very best, then you get the very best and you stop getting pleasure anymore from the small things. Those lose their pleasure for you. They also had people look at waterfalls and things like that and looked at the pleasure they got from those. So my advice for new millionaires is don't splurge for the best straight away. You need to do it very gradually. But what about money and happiness? This is a man I know who happens to be very rich. He's enjoying himself there with his money and happiness. Now, the famous finding relating to money and happiness is known as the Easterlin paradox, which lots of you might have heard of. So this is the finding that within a country, rich people are on average happier than people with less money. But when you compare the level of happiness between different countries, average income only makes people happier until it reaches about $15,000, £15,000 or £20,000 or £25,000, depending on which study you look at. But a more recent study has tracked people for far, far longer and found that this increase in happiness does seem to continue. So now some researchers argue that it continues up to when people are earning about £75,000, that they'll be happier than the others. Others, that it might continue on forever, that the more people have, the happier they are. But, of course, these are only averages, so you can, of course, still be rich and miserable. But what's really interesting is that the rest of us overestimate the difference that income makes. So if you ask people how happy somebody earning £90,000 is, people will say that they're much happier than they really are. If you ask people how much somebody earning a much lower income is, people will think that they are much unhappier than they actually are. But what I find interesting is not so much, in a way, the acquisition of money for its own sake, but how people can spend what they do have in a way that maximises their own happiness. There's lots of interesting research from psychologist Elizabeth Dunn in the US on this, which boils down to you should spend money on experiences, not on products in order to maximise your happiness you get from that money. And one of the reasons is that we anticipate experiences for much more than we do anticipating, say, buying a widescreen TV. We don't think that much about what it's going to be like, whereas you might think for ages about a holiday and what's what that's going to be like. Or this next study will give you a clue about how to spend money as well. People were given an envelope with either $5 or $20 in it. And the envelope had a note in it, which either said this, do spend the money on yourself, you've got until 5 o'clock to do it. Or it said this, please spend the money on someone else or give it to charity. Again, they've got till 5 o'clock to do it. So the first group, who had to spend the money on themselves, bought earrings and sushi and coffees. The second group, who had to spend it on other people, bought toys for relatives and gifts for people, and or gave the money to charity. And when they rated their mood at the end of the day, the people who'd had to spend their money on other people had significantly higher ratings of their moods than the people who had spent it on themselves. And you may have seen the sort of movement that there is online with some people suggesting that you should pay for things for strangers to make yourself happier, that you should stand in the coffee shop queue and say that you'll pay for the persons behind you, or that you should go to the motorway toll booth abroad and say you'll pay for the person behind you. Now, suspicious people amongst you might wonder whether the person in the toll booth will really pay for the one behind them or keep it for themselves, but I wouldn't like to suggest that they would do that. So giving money away does make us happier, and in low-income countries, men give away more money to charity. In high-income countries, women give away more money to charity. But what about richer and poorer people? There's a whole literature on whether richer people are meaner or not. We'll all know the odd richer person who seems to be last to go to the bar to get around in. On the other hand, we've got no generous people too, and vice versa with people with less money. The psychologist Paul Piff in the US has done loads of studies on this, where he observed people crossing zebra crossings, and he looked to see which cars would stop, and he found the expensive cars were less likely to stop than the cheaper cars. He also got people to play Monopoly, and he made some players artificially rich at the beginning by just giving them a load of money to start the Monopoly game with, and he would find that they would, you know, triumphantly stick their boot or their car around the board, you know, very sort of loudly, and that they ate more of the pretzels that had been left out for them. And also at the end, which was interesting, when they won, inevitably, because they started with loads more money so they could buy loads of houses, when they won, they then asked them why they thought they'd won, and they thought they'd won because of their own skill, which was interesting. He even found a higher proportion of rich people who said that if they were on the Titanic, they would deserve to be in the first lifeboat, actually deserve to be in the first lifeboat, which I thought was interesting. So it's not looking good for rich people so far, but there is also a whole other load of evidence suggesting that they are generous. So the super rich give away 4.44% of their money, compared with an average of 2.3%. Now, you could argue, well, they can afford to do it, because once you've got the basics, the other people need to buy the basics first and have less to give away. They've also done experiments where they drop letters and see if people will post them, and people are more likely to post the letters in richer areas. There are more living kidney donations in the richer states in the US, Utah being at the top of those. So I've shown you a few ways that we can learn about mind over money, but I think charities could also learn from some of this research as well when they design their appeals. This is a very typical appeal with a very pretty child, and charity appeals often will feature pretty children. But in fact, research shows that those children are seen as more popular and more able to help themselves and more likely to get help from other people. So actually, it could be a mistake to have children that are too pretty because people think, oh, they'll be fine. Also, interestingly, and a new research last year found that people tend to decide how much to give to an appeal according to the number of people who've been killed rather than the number of survivors after an earthquake, say. In a way, what matters is the number of survivors when it comes to how much money is needed for a place. But people will look much more at the number killed. So what charities need to do is to stress what survivors need and how many there are, and to show photos where children aren't too attractive, but where they also look active and as though they are starting to help themselves. People also don't like the pictures where people look as if they're passively waiting for help. So if you had a family starting to build themselves a shelter, then people would be more likely to give more money. So I have lots more tips, all that are evidence-based, and I'm sure some of those will come up in your questions. There's lots more to say about, you know, when financial incentives do and don't work and how easily they can backfire and how they can work in very specific circumstances, but only if you get it absolutely right. I think that many of you will have heard of the famous studies in the nursery in Israel, where they were fed up with parents turning up late to pick up their kids and staff having to wait for them, and so they decided to institute a system of fines. After they'd instituted the system of fines, every parent was then late at least once a week, because they now saw this as a service they were paying for. So it reframed the whole thing, and then they thought, oh, well, I'm paying for the service. Yes, it's quite a lot as well. And they thought, oh, well, it's quite a lot, but never mind. I need to get this done at work or whatever. So after that, it completely backfired and didn't work. People were much kinder when they thought the poor staff were waiting for them. So they got rid of the scheme, and then when they studied what happened afterwards, it turned out that they didn't go back. Their behaviour didn't go back again. So one thing with financial incentives is you need to be sure you can carry on with them, but you also need to be sure that they will work in that situation and not crowd out people's goodwill or make people suspicious. There was a study done in Switzerland where they looked at how much money people would... They offered people money to have a nuclear dump situated near them. And they offered them lots of money. It was something like 1,500 euros a year, continuously. And when they offered more money, people were less likely to agree that it would be okay to have it near them. So, you know, people then thought, rather than thinking, well, it's got to go somewhere, I suppose it might as well be here, the community has to put up with this, it needs to be somewhere. Instead, people thought, well, why is it so bad that they're having to bribe us? What is it they're after? So I think that's one where people need to be very careful. And then it's also interesting when you look at... I looked very hard to find any academic studies of bankers' bonuses and whether they work or not. And I can't find a single study that is done of bankers' bonuses. Now, it could be that banks are quietly doing the studies, but not doing them themselves, but not publishing them, or that it hasn't actually been done to see whether they work or not. But if you apply some of the other evidence about financial incentives to bankers' bonuses, then... What is very clear, and particularly clear from some research in the US, is that if you're going to try to use a financial incentive, you need to be very clear about what behaviour it is you're looking for, what you want them to do, and they need to know how to do it. So, you know, you could offer me £1 million to beat Andy Murray at tennis, and I'm still not going to be able to do it much as I'd like to get that £1 million. So they need to know how they can do it, and you also... And what is it you want them to do? Do you want them to stay longer hours, or do you want them to take more risks? Do you want them to take less risks? Do you want them to consult with other people more? You need to know what it is you want them to do, and it needs to be very transparent. And, of course, the bonus system is famously not transparent, with people waiting, not knowing when they'll be called into offices to be told what they have or haven't got. The evidence about whether they will do work is very limited. I also look at other things like why it's so hard to save up money and how it is that children learn about money. So there are all sorts of tips there. Now, and looking at research from around the world has made me think very differently about money myself. So I'm very grateful to all the researchers who designed all these clever studies. I look at more than 250 studies in the book. So I haven't named all those researchers today, but all the names are in the book. So hopefully I've made you wonder a bit more about money too, I thought I will donate these to the RSA if you would like these pieces, then you may have these. Thank you. Oops.
Thank you so much, Claudia. Fascinating talk, and as I mentioned earlier, I really love the book. The last chapter of the book is actually a really handy summary of a whole bunch of money tips. And these are things that we each as individuals can do starting immediately to help keep mind over money. So I guess my first question is really about organizations. So do you think that there's a role for organizations to help us? And if so, what is that role? And by organizations, it could be anything from schools, businesses, workplaces, or regulatory bodies.
Yeah, I mean, I think the question about schools is particularly interesting. You know, some people are saying that, you know, I do feel a bit sorry for schools because everyone's always saying, oh, schools need to teach them this and they need to teach them that and they need to teach them this. And I realise there are limited hours in the day. But I think there are things to do with, I mean, it's interesting with your report about financial capability. I think there are things that children could be taught about money in schools, and not necessarily just, you know, you can teach how to work out a budget, but not even necessarily just those things, but about how we think and how we make decisions. Because then children could apply that to any sorts of decisions they're making, and to learn about the biases that there are and why we might not always judge things right when we make decisions. I think that would be a useful thing for them to learn. I think organisations, I think, could I mean, it depends what sort of organisations, but say, you know, workplaces could. There's been some really clever systems to try to help people save money, for example, and so that's just something that, you know, workplaces could do when they have their, you know, pension schemes also have kind of saving schemes as well. So you know, Richard Thaler's famously the Save More Tomorrow scheme, where people promised to pay and some of their future salary when they had pay rises, that they would pay a little bit more into their savings. So it doesn't feel so painful now, because spending money now always feels very painful. And instead they're promising it in the future, and they're knowing that they will have had a pay rise by then, and so it won't seem so bad. It will be what they're already accustomed to. And the moment, you know, taking money away is always harder, and we hate loss, and there's lots and lots of research on loss aversion and how we hate loss more than winning. More than we enjoy winning, in fact, and we'll do anything to avoid loss. And so I think, you know, workplaces could have saving schemes like that make it easier for people.
Great, thank you. I have a couple more questions before then we open it out to the audience. In the book, you talk about the difference between using cash versus contactless or debit or credit cards. When cash is a thing of the past, or if we are moving towards a cashless society, will this undermine our ability to manage our money well, and what can we do about it?
Yeah, it's really interesting, and obviously the figures have just come out showing that it'll be very soon when payments made on cards overtake cash. And there have been a few interesting studies done about this. So in one study in the US, they followed people's shopping habits for a year. They followed their supermarket bills, and half of them paid with cards all the time and half of them paid with cash. And the people who paid with cards not only spent more over the time, over the year, but they bought more unhealthy treats for themselves. And so I think it is really fascinating, the idea that money, having money, using contactless cards and stuff, might almost make things seem like they don't count. And so if you're buying very small things, you know, you're buying a sandwich or something, or why not have some chocolate as well, because the money doesn't count, because that's not really real, because it's on this card. And so maybe the calories or whatever, the unhealthiness doesn't quite count either. I think it's interesting that people discounted that for themselves. Another study, they got students to bid for basketball tickets for a popular game where it was very hard to get rid of tickets, and they could choose how much they bid. And they said to them, would they like to bid any amount they chose? And half of them were told they would need to pay in cash. There was a cash machine right by that they could go to get it. The others could pay on cards. People were prepared to pay almost twice as much if it was on the card. And so it's almost as if people are making slightly different decisions based on it being on the card. And I think it's partly because we have such a strong attachment to the piece of paper, as I, you know, demonstrated when I shredded it. We really know what that is worth, and we really think about that very strongly. And I think we don't yet think so strongly about that with cards or with money on a screen. Figures on a screen don't mean quite so much. But I think over time we will become accustomed to that. Like, you know, I think we do become accustomed to most things. It's usually all right. So I think in time we will get used to that. Otherwise everybody will be broke and very unhealthy. But
great. Okay, thank you. Something that I found really fascinating in your book was this talk of how language can affect how we spend or save. And I think you mentioned that at least in Ethiopia, the language that you speak is a better predictor of how much you will of your savings habits than your beliefs about the importance of savings, which just sounds incredible to me. But I'm hoping you can tell us a little bit more about that. And does this mean we should all be learning certain different languages?
It's really extraordinary, this, and slightly bizarre, as you say. So this research is looking at the languages that people speak and how certain languages are known as strong future time languages, where the future tense has is very specific and has very different words for it. So like in English, we say, you know, it will be cold tomorrow. It's cold tomorrow doesn't make sense in English. We have to say it will be cold. It's very clear we're talking about the future, and we use different language in order to indicate the future. In a language like German, say, that's known as a weak future time language. And so so you can say, es ist kalt morgen, it will be cold tomorrow. And you could also say, es ist kalt, it is cold today. So you use the present tense, but just have the tomorrow or whatever indicating when the time is. And so what seems really remarkable is that the countries where there is a strong future time language, people are less likely to save up so much money because it seems far away, and the implication is it seems far away in the future. And so they've looked at the GDP across loads of countries, they've looked at the savings amounts across loads of countries, and whether they're weak or strong future time languages. And people save more if the future is expressed in almost the same way as the present. So it's almost as if we put our minds into the future and think, that's miles away, I don't need to save up the money. But in languages where the future doesn't feel so far away because the language is more similar, people seem to save up more. So the reason they did part of the study in Ethiopia was that there are many different languages spoken, and many different languages are spoken amongst different groups, but of similar incomes. And so they were able to demonstrate that the people who spoke the weak future time languages saved up more money than the others did, which is really extraordinary. So you could decide, well, we all need to learn German then, or a particular language used in Ethiopia, but you need to become fluent in it, because you'd almost need to be thinking in it for your savings to do that. So it could be quite a long-term strategy to enable you to save some more money.
Not an easy fix.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, great. Well, let's open it up to the audience.
Hi, Claudia. Owen Pringle Fellow. In recent years, we've seen a move towards, access versus ownership. And I guess taken to its logical, absolute conclusion, you could result in something that amounts to a universal basic income. What effect do you think that will have on how we value things?
I think that's really interesting, because I think this whole idea of a universal basic income is a really interesting idea. And this idea of everyone, say, having, you know, £20,000, and then deciding whether they want to, you know, earn more on top of that or not, or use that. I think it's a good question about whether it will change how we value things. I think that there will still be differences, big differences in how much people have. Obviously, it would narrow the gap. But I think that people will still value expensive things a lot. I don't think it will change that people like the things that they think are expensive better. I don't think will change. I think everyone will carry on wanting that. I think what might change is people's attitudes towards... I mean, there's quite troubling research about the general population's attitudes towards people with not very much money. And there's troubling research about people, despising poor people, and people this demonstrated that in brain scanners that areas for disgust will light up when people are seeing pictures of people they know that are poor. And I think it may stop the thing that people quite often will say, oh, but these people will say they're poor, but look at their giant screen telly. How come they can afford that? Whereas actually that might be, if you can't go out, that might be a very sensible thing to do. And people won't say, oh, look at the giant screen telly if people are getting a projector in their home, and, you know, somebody better off is having a projector and a nice big film on their screen. That suddenly counts as a home cinema, whereas somebody having a big screen, you know, counts as something that some will disapprove of. So I think that might change a bit.
I hope I listened correctly. You gave an example of people have an envelope with £5 note and the choice whether to spend it on themselves or on others. and they opted on spending it on others. Could it be the case that they perhaps suffer with guilt?
They tell them which to spend it on. So I may not be explaining that quite clearly, but they tell them which one to spend it on. So half of them have to spend it on themselves, and half of them have to spend it on other people. They can't choose for themselves, so that because then you may get the the people who are already happier deciding to spend it on other people. So they can't choose which one to spend it on. So you suggested the people who spent it on themselves might feel guilty, so they don't feel happy. Yeah, I mean, I think that's an interesting suggestion. I think that they don't know what the other group is doing, so they don't know that the other group is being kind and spending it on someone else. So I'm wondering if they would feel guilty, because I think they would just think, oh, here's this nice present I've got, and somebody's giving me this thing, so I'm going to spend it.
Hi. Aristotle had an interesting idea. He said, don't reward people with money, reward people with recognition. 2,000 years later, I don't know a society that's done that. But if you think it right back to the basics, you reward people with money in order that they go up Maslow's triangle and they gain their self-respect. So actually, Aristotle's logic is correct. Psychologically, it doesn't work. Do you want to think about that or say something about that? Because I think it's a very interesting and regrettable thing about us human beings.
Yes, no, I think it's interesting. It goes back to the financial incentives and rewarding bankers, say, with huge bonuses, which makes, everybody else many other people so angry and annoyed by the unfairness of that. And, there's research from Bristol University showing that when profits go up, bonuses go up, or when profits go down, bonuses don't go down, and that makes people even more annoyed. And in a way, I think what it could be saying to people working in jobs like banking is it trying to say to them, this job is so bad that the only way you'll like it is if you get loads of money? And, we do need banks, and we do need institutions and financial institutions, and so maybe it would be good if it could be reframed. That kind of job was reframed as a job that's necessary, a job that's needed, and a job that you might want to do because it's interesting and rewarding in other ways, and a necessary job. And that I think, I mean, I completely agree with you that financial rewards then look like too big a thing in certain jobs, and that of course that what is reassuring is that there are lots of people who are not choosing their jobs based on their maximum financial reward. It's not that everyone is applying to, say, work in the city, or lots of people do still want to do other things. And I think maybe people are quite good at judging for themselves what kind of reward they want. I mean, it's interesting that we'll often meet people in the city who will say that they're going to, and I can remember when I was in my 20s, knowing people working in the city who would all insist that they were going to retire at 30, and that they were just going to get enough money for a while, and then they were going to do what they really wanted to do. And, of course, most of them are still doing it, and by then people get used to having the money, and becoming accustomed to having less again is difficult. I think it's interesting that there was some research out a couple of months ago about asking students what their main motivations were in choosing what careers they were going to choose. And the proportion who say that they'll choose them because it's money and a steady job with a good income and the possibility of promotion is gradually increasing. And it's still not most of them, which is maybe reassuring, but that number is increasing. And I've increasingly been talking to young people and to students of my own, where some will say, well, what we want to do is, what I'd really like to do is this, but I could do that at weekends. I could have that as a hobby at weekends and just get, what I should do is get a sensible job. And I think that seems to be increasing, and particularly at the moment, obviously the price of properties and rent is so huge that maybe that looms larger than it did, when I was a student. But I think it's interesting that it seems to be going in that direction. And maybe a pity.
Hi, Claudia. Could I just go back to the first story you told about Coney Arwan? I was in the wine business for a long time, and I've had exactly the opposite experience, is that if you let people taste blind, and then they realise that one wine is a lot cheaper than the other one, they have exactly the opposite thing. They say, good Lord, I'm never going to spend that much money on the expensive wine. I'll take the cheap one every time, because the expensive one is not worth it in their view. So that was point one.
Yeah, because they've already tasted it blind, whereas they've
It blind, they haven't been told anything, and then they're told, you've tasted these two. Or they can also be told, one is expensive and one is cheap, just say which one you like.
That's good.
And then they will go for the one they like, and they'll be staggered that the other one was much more expensive. Just one other thing to say, too, is that there's another book, not about Coney Island, but about billionaires' vinegar, Hardy Rodenstock. So for those in the audience or for you as well, that's equally entertaining. That was one of the most expensive bottles of wine ever sold. I think it was Lafitte 1789, allegedly, and then it wasn't. It was sold for £105,000, I think, to Malcolm Forbes, or Forbes, a rich chap. So the wine thing is, but we can work both ways, is really what I'm saying.
Yes, so I like the idea that people will, also you might wonder if people would change their minds afterwards to try to then look for the things that must be good about the expensive one, to try to sort of get there afterwards would be interesting. Thanks for that.
Thank you. Yep, just there.
Hi, I'm interested in peer group pressure, whether how people compare themselves to, say, their neighbours or the people close to them, and whether they need to be richer than them or whether they need to be level with them and things like that. And also the division between developed nations and developing nations, that we pay for a lot of goods that somewhere in the supply chain there may be exploitation going on, and the mentality of companies in that they only want to pay the lowest price, and whether there's anything we can do to tackle that in order to tackle exploitation.
Yeah, so to take your first one about the what we think of our peers, so yes, there is some evidence. There was an interesting study in the States where they asked people whether they'd rather earn twice the amount of money, but have all their friends earning four times the amount of money, i.e. twice what they did, or whether they would rather earn less but earn double what their friends had. And most people said they would rather earn less but have double what their friends had, which was interesting because the amounts were quite high, so why not, you know, have the higher one? And so I think, yes, people definitely do compare themselves with what other people have and start to, and which is why there are studies showing that people living in social housing in areas next to very rich houses will feel less happy. You know, will be more affected by their relative poverty than if they couldn't see that. And with what is a shame from that is that then, if you wanted to improve people's well-being, that would suggest that then you should completely separate everybody by income, which would, I think, would be wrong for society But I think definitely people do make those comparisons, and I think those comparisons will carry on a lot as well. In answer to your other question about what to do to make companies behave more ethically, I think all that can be done is the continued pressure that there is gradually, that, you know, that when it's publicised that companies are, you know, exploiting people or using people, you know, children in factories, etc., and doing things that they shouldn't be doing, that those are exposed more and more often, and that it's until it becomes unfeasible for those companies to carry on doing that because it damages their reputations so much. So I think we just have to hope that carries on. Luxury goods may or may not have involved exploitation, and some cheap goods may or may not have involved exploitation. And so I think what's difficult, especially for consumers judging and trying to work out what is ethical for them to buy, is that you can't know which ones it was necessarily, whether it was the price of the goods doesn't seem to represent whether there was exploitation or not, because there have been cases where very expensive goods have been made inappropriately. So it's not just about making them really cheap, I think.
Okay, so we only have time for one more or two if they're super quick in front of Adana.
Riffo has spent so much on credit card, and initially she went to see a psychologist and she was advised to cut all these cards and put it in a jar. So can you tell me a bit about it?
So she was advised to cut the cards up?
Yes, and put it in a jar.
What, put the cards into a jar?
Yes.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, like saving money in a jar. So was that there to remind her that this was what she was doing and not to spend money?
Yes, I thought you know the story.
So, oh, no, that's an interesting story.
I read it a while ago. And I saw the photograph of the cards on the jar.
Oh, that's very interesting. I should look that up.
Great, thank you. And then we have one from Twitter.
Yeah, we've got a quick question from Twitter. Someone wants to know, to what extent is our relationship with money a mirror of or a reaction to our parents' relationship with money?
With money. Oh, yeah, that's a really interesting question, actually. We do definitely learn an enormous amount about money from our parents and from what we see earlier on, which is why it's good if parents slightly think out loud about their spending, you know, explain that, well, we're actually, I'm not choosing this one because it's not good value. It's more than we can afford, and we don't actually really need that. It'd be better to have something else. And so children definitely take a lot from how they see their parents do it. What's really interesting, though, is that then you can often see within the same family, and people may, you know, have experience of this themselves, that you might have one sibling who's terrible with money and one who's brilliant with money and always seems to be, you know, saving it up and having it. And so it's clear that not everything is coming from the parents, or they wouldn't have copied the same, but that personality factors come into it a lot as well. And so, not surprisingly, when you look at personality, big studies of personality like Adrian Furnham at UCL has done lots of these, that they will find that the conscientious people who score high on conscientiousness save more money, which, you know, isn't hugely surprising, but it does show how people's individual personalities will come into it as well. Thank
you. Great. Well, just before we finish up, one last question is, where next for this field? What would you say is the most important piece of research that still needs to be done in this area?
I think that's a really interesting question. I think that to do more on what works with teaching people about money, so not just teaching about budgeting, but to do really good trials of what works with teaching people about their thinking and their decision making, and how that could then work best to change what they do in practice to make it easier for people.
Great. Well, thank you. So sadly, we've run out of time. Mind Over Money. It's a very enjoyable read, and there's over 250 experiments and pieces of research that are all summarized in there. It's just a fabulous book. I'd like to thank all of you guys for coming today, and everyone who was listening online, and thank you also for all the wonderful questions. And now I'd just like to ask you to join me in thanking Claudia for her fantastic talk.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.